Welcome to episode 309 of The Lab. I'm Brad Barton.
I'm Phil Barton.
This is one in our continuing series on space and space travel. If you'd like to find the other episodes, you can check them out at thelabwithbrad.com.
Like a library. Why not?
No card necessary.
No late fees.
Yeah. It's all there. It's all for free.
Best library ever.
Right. So in our last episode, we talked about the 1986 Space Challenger disaster.
We did.
That wasn't the only space shuttle disaster.
Okay.
So the external fuel tank.
Moving on.
It was made by Lockheed Martin.
Mm, oh, cool. Good for them.
Its diameter was 27.6 feet.
Mm.
And it actually had three tanks inside of it. All of them had the same diameter.
Oh.
Just a little bit shy of 30 feet.
Nothing you could hug.
Well, sure you can.
need some other bodies in there. Yeah. Okay.
At the bottom was the liquid hydrogen tank. It was 97 feet long.
Ooh.
The fuel weighed a bit over 234,000 pounds.
Oh, geez.
And then in the middle, they had an intertank. It was 22 feet long. It held electronics and so forth, and also helped the ring that the boosters connected to.
Okay.
Was right there on that intertank.
Oh, okay.
The LOX tank, liquid oxygen.
Well, ooh.
It was 54.6 feet long.
Okay.
So quite a bit shorter than the 97 point what have you hydrogen tank.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
Its fuel weighed more than 1,380,000 pounds.
Oh, heavy.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is a much larger tank for the liquid hydrogen, but that fuel weighed about one-third as much as the liquid oxygen. Because a hydrogen atom is approximately 1/16 the mass of an oxygen atom. That's why.
Mm-hmm.
So the total length was 153 feet.
Mm-hmm.
Empty, it was 58,500 pounds.
Okay.
At liftoff, it was 1,680,000 feet. Feet, I mean.
Oh, wow, whoa, wait a
pounds,
minute.
Pounds. The tank just got really long. That's how they got to space.
Well, they're NASA. They can do weird physics. Yeah.
Anyway, they did not carry it fully fueled up, right? I mean, even without the fuel on board, it was still a very heavy assembly with the orbiter and the two boosters and the tank.
Yeah, yeah.
Which they had to move. Which we talked about.
Yes, we did.
On Monday. This is the first time we ever missed a week by accident.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, occasionally a holiday snuck up, and we still took the holiday. Yeah. This is the first time we didn't have a week, an episode in a week, and we didn't mean to do that way.
Mistakes were made.
Let's talk about 1884.
Okay.
This company called the Marion Steam Shovel.
Mm-hmm.
Or Marion Steam Shovels was founded. And, you know, as you might expect, they were making steam shovels.
What? Imagine that. That's so, a good name.
You know, in addition to killing John Henry, they also helped with things like the Hoover Dam and digging the Panama Canal.
Was that the what was that president? FDR? It was like a...
Uh-huh.
Okay, well, never mind.
I think Hoover was involved. He was a president. It was a dam.
Good point, right?
Anyway, they eventually changed the name to Marion Power Shovel.
Oh.
Because they stopped using steam and started using diesel and other such things.
Mm-hmm.
In 1965, at a cost of $14 million apiece, they made these two huge vehicles.
Okay.
Now, by this time, they'd been involved in the coal mining industry. They'd made huge vehicles before.
Right.
This thing was designed to carry rockets.
Okay.
1965, they made two of them. Mm-hmm. They eventually got nicknamed Hans and Franz. And yeah, it's after the Saturday Night Live skit.
Here to pump you up.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. And they carried the Saturn rockets for the Apollo program and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And later, for about 30 years, they were carrying the space shuttles around.
Oh, okay.
132 by 114 feet.
Holy crap.
It was 20 to 26 feet tall.
Okay.
That might sound kind of funny. It's because they could move the top of it with this hydraulic jack system. Okay. And that's actually how they'd load the vehicle. They'd take it into the assembly building. Uh-huh. And they'd have hoisted up whatever vehicle it was with a crane. Okay. And I imagine that crane was a piece of work, too. Yeah, right. And then they'd raise the platform from underneath, mm-hmm. attach the vehicle to their mobile launch platform.
Cool.
Then lower back down to what he called cruising height. Cruising is debatable, by the way, because yeah. a thing weighed about 6.5 million pounds.
Okay.
Without being loaded.
Okay.
Then it would carry anywhere from 10 to 18 million more pounds. Right. Like, I think the space shuttle was 12 million. So you're wandering around with like 18 million pounds.
Yeah.
You're not going to set any speed records.
This thing will never be in the passing lane.
Even when unloaded, its top speed was 2 miles an hour, roughly. Oh. Its top speed when loaded was 1 mile an hour. It took anywhere from 5 to 7 hours to move the vehicle from the assembly building to the launch pad. Mm-hmm. And they rotate drivers every 2 hours or so, get a fresh guy in there.
Yeah, you just walk up to it, you know. You catch up with the vehicle, let the other guy get out.
They actually had people, spotters, mm-hmm. about 20 people. Some of them would ride on top of the thing. Some of them would walk along, and they'd all have radios. Because mm-hmm. the driver, he's in this cab.
Yeah.
And according to Wikipedia, they had one on the front and one on the back. Mm-hmm. Nobody else confirmed that. Nobody else disagreed with that either, but...
But who knows?
Yeah. You got a control room with 3 or 4 engineers in it, mm-hmm. monitoring the things, and then you got the driver.
Yeah.
And one of the drivers was saying, this is sort of like driving a cruise ship. You turn the wheel, mm-hmm. and then it would turn.
Eventually, yeah.
He said you had to be looking ahead by 1 to 3 minutes, depending upon what was coming up next.
Oh, wow. Mm.
It was powered by engines from Alco.
Okay.
American Locomotive Company.
Oh.
Two of them. Two V16, 16-cylinder, mm-hmm. Turbocharged, 2,750 horsepower engines.
That was geared way down, I guess.
Yeah. Well, actually, they turned the generators with that, uh-huh. which then powered the 16 separate electric drive motors.
Aha!
Under each corner was a double track under each corner.
Okay.
And then, you know, the front axle and the back axle, I'm assuming, were where the power came in. Mm-hmm. Yeah, those axles could swivel. And they were actually being slow on purpose. The thing could go at command forward by 1/8 inch and then stop.
Whoa.
Try doing that with your pickup.
You burn your clutch out just trying to. Yeah, that's a creep. That's a creep.
Then they had they still do, this amazingly complicated keep it level system.
That strikes me as important.
Yeah.
Dang things vertical.
Yeah, actually they go up a ramp and it was like 5 degrees. Mm. So they had to compensate for that.
Oh, wow.
They were able to keep it within 10 minutes of arc. What does that mean?
Things, yeah.
So if you're at the bottom of a pole, and you move it slightly, it doesn't move much down at the bottom, right?
Right, right.
But up at the top, it just whooshes back and forth.
Okay.
So 10 minutes of arc tilt meant that at the top of the 363-foot-tall Saturn V, it would move less than a foot.
Oh, goodness sakes. Okay. Yeah,
so really high tolerance thingy here.
Skyscrapers move more than that. That's just when it's windy.
A couple other factoids. Each track was made up of 57 shoes, whatever that means.
Oh, the people running around barefoot.
This is stolen shoes for NASA. That can't be right. The road was, they had sand that was compressed. Mm-hmm. And then they had what they called hydraulically compressed limestone. And then they had 3 or 4 feet of rock on top of that.
Okay.
And every time it drove, rock was crushed underneath it, and bits would fly out. It's just that heavy.
Mm-hmm. Nice. You know, I want to put a penny on that track.
How could you tell? It's still running, by the way.
Oh,
more than 50
it.
Years of service, and they actually refurbished one to carry a little bit more weight for this thingy that they're trying to make. The SSL, I don't know what it stands for. Mm. They may have already built the damn thing. I haven't been paying attention to what's happening lately.
It's not secure socket layer, I can tell you that.
Anyway, yeah, there's a rig for you. So they covered the tank in foam.
Oh.
For reasons.
Wait, but the inside of the...
No, the outside of the tank. That orange, ugly looking... Yeah. The foam. I'm not sure how hard or soft it was, because like I've seen things that once it sets, it's the foam. Mm-hmm. It's kind of... It feels like concrete.
Okay. Yeah. Is Nerf NASA's fault? I mean... that extra foam.
External fuel tank by Nerf.
I don't know.
Yeah. No, they had to put foam around the hydrogen tank because otherwise air would start to condense on the metal.
Oh, that's bad.
Yeah, that's how cold it is. And also to keep it from warming up more than it had to.
Mm, okay.
The liquid oxygen tank, it's still super cold, but nowhere near as super cold as liquid hydrogen.
Mm-hmm.
And they still put the foam around it because it was going to heat up as it tears through the atmosphere on the way up.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, because the external fuel tank was the one bit of the assembly that they never tried to reuse.
Okay,
they dumped it about 8.5 minutes into the mission, right after the main engine cuts off. And, you know, this throws me off. I always thought when I was growing up that there were also fuel tanks for the main engines on the orbiter.
Yeah.
But all the fuel for the main engines came from the external fuel tank.
Oh.
Had these big, thick, hosey, pipey thingies. They called them umbilicals.
Okay. I like your first explanation.
And once it was time to separate, they'd shut the valves off so they could be sure there's no fuel in the umbilicals.
Oh,
important. And then sever them with explosive charges. they like those.
Yeah, I mean, just anything they can blow up, right?
But there were issues with the foam.
Oh.
Story gets kind of weird. Remember back with the O-rings?
Yeah.
How NASA knew there was a problem the whole time?
Keep trucking along.
They had all these problems with foam tearing off of the external tank.
Okay.
And flying about. And, you know, while they were going up, the orbiter was underneath the tank. It would tend to fall towards the orbiter.
Did Lockheed Martin come back and say, hey, man, because they did before, we really like this orbiter. Wait, yeah.
All right. So was it Lockheed Martin? No, it was Rockwell.
That's
that
what
made
I was
orbiter.
Just about to correct myself with.
Anyway, the orbiter had been hit by this foam on several missions, causing anywhere from minor to downright, this is scary damage to the heat tiles.
Oh, goodness. Yeah, yeah.
Yes. Well, it was 2003. Just a couple of years after the September 11th, 2001 attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon.
Mm-hmm.
You remember that?
Yes, yes.
So, and this was going to be the mission with our first Israeli astronaut.
Mm-hmm.
So there was heightened security, both for the launch and for the landing site.
Makes sense, yeah.
So while they were taking off, a piece of foam broke off the tank.
Okay.
And actually, specifically, this was by the bipod. It's a section that connected the orbiter to the tank. They cover those bits with foam to keep ice from building up. Mm. Because if ice breaks off, you know, that would be dangerous.
Yeah.
So the foam broke off. And that was dangerous. It hit the leading edge of the left wing.
Oh. Mm.
Anyway, they get to orbit. Mm-hmm. Everything's fine. They have about a 2-week mission.
Okay.
And meanwhile, people were looking at some of these pictures going, something hit it. Something hit it hard.
How hard? I mean, are we concerned? I feel concerned.
Well, yeah. So something funny happened. All these problems with the foam mess had decided it wasn't that big a deal because nothing had gone that wrong before.
This sounds familiar. Okay.
Yeah, kind of like what was going on with the O-rings. Mm. And a whole bunch of engineers said, hey, do you think we could get some of the DOD satellites to image this for us? Or maybe they could do an impromptu spacewalk. Let's see what's going on.
Yeah, yeah.
The attitude at Mission Control, and also shared by the astronauts, was that if there is too much damage to the heat tiles or the orbiter, there's nothing you can do about it. So why
carry on?
Let's not even look. Let's just have a good mission and then die happy.
Yeah, why get that test for cancer? I mean, what if they tell you bad news?
So as far as they could tell, it hit that leading edge, which they call reinforced carbon-carbon. What's carbon-carbon?
Carbon-carbon? I don't know. No.
Yeah, well, it ended up with like a basketball-sized hole in it. And they didn't know. Nobody knew.
There was an opportunity to know.
Yeah. And the thing is, like, this whole idea that nothing could be done, according to After Action reports, they had a scheduled launch for the Atlantis.
Oh.
And they also had an extended stay package for the orbiter. And if they'd rushed the launch of the Atlantis a bit, there was like a 5-day overlap. They could have sent the Atlantis up and taken them off of the compromised orbiter.
What, were they tired? They didn't want to crunch the numbers? Yeah. So tired of orbital dynamics.
It'll be fine.
Oh, no.
There was another suggestion that they could have fixed it by cannibalizing some of the metal from inside the crew cabin and bracing it with a frozen chunk of water.
Yeah.
Though that was considered a riskier plan. And all of this is happening, hindsight, 2020. You know,
right? I was actually going to say that, yeah.
So, on February 1st, 2003, they re-enter.
Here we go.
Yes. The first indication of a problem was that some sensors were going offline. Not really that big a deal. This sort of thing has happened before.
They get shook about, yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, seem to have lost tire pressure.
Tire pressure?
Yeah. That's a weird little one.
Yeah.
And then about 9 o'clock at the landing site, which is Florida this time, they were still talking about the tire pressure being gone, and the mission commander from the orbiter had a transmission cut off in mid-sentence. And that's when they lost contact with the orbiter, about 16 minutes before the scheduled landing.
Okay.
And what happened is that this hole allowed superheated gas into the left wing. And there's actually some links, you can find them by going to thelabwithbad.com, that shows some footage captured by local news stations. They weren't really sure what was going on, but you'd see the regular trail as it's going across Texas, and bits falling off of it.
That's not good.
No, it's not good at all. Broke up, and according to the After Action report, the crew experienced 4 separate problems, each one of which would be fatal.
Oh, good.
The first was when the orbiter broke up. The crew cabin was sort of intact, but the midsection tore off, and they lost pressure.
Oh.
Very quickly. They probably lost consciousness at that point.
One can hope.
Could have or would have died from low oxygen and embolisms. They were still way up there.
Yeah.
Going at something like Mach 18. Then the crew cabin starts to tumble.
Okay.
That would have been enough to kill them, especially since they were unconscious and unable to brace against the motions.
Oh, goodness. Yeah.
Then the cabin heats up and, you know, fragments of molten metal start flying through it.
That's also bad.
Yeah, which also would have been fatal. And then it breaks apart entirely, and they hit the atmosphere at Mach 18 or what have you.
In their, which also, their little suits?
Yes, yeah. Would have been fatal. And then, of course, they hit the ground. Then they get to the finger-pointing and name-calling. The interesting part about this is, like, Lockheed Martin's facility that actually made the tank was in New Orleans.
Oh.
And that's where they sprayed the foam on.
Okay.
And they figured out pretty quickly that, yeah, the foam spooling off was probably what caused the accident. And they're like, okay, we need to go over here and get them, teach them to put foam on.
Oh, no. Okay.
It took 2 years of further research and testing to figure out that the problem was actually during the fueling of the tank.
Oh.
Because it went from, you know, whatever the local ambient temperature was to way down in liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen, cold,
mm-hmm.
that cracked the foam.
Oh.
Actually sent an official letter. We're sorry, guys. It's not your fault.
At that point, you know, after being taught how to do what you do. Screw you, NASA!
And they made some other changes, but they still had some problems with foam shedding after this terrible tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
And then they kind of backed off of the space shuttle program. It took a couple of years before they flew again at all.
Yeah.
And the remaining missions, all the way up to 2011, were almost all just to build the International Space Station.
Oh, okay.
After that, American astronauts had to hitch a ride on a Russian rocket.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't actually launch American astronauts on an American-built rocket again until 2020.
Oh.
And that one was not built by NASA.
Uh-huh.
But we're going to talk about that.
Here we go.
Next time. See you then.
Bye.